time to start. I'm glad to be here this morning. I was in Atlanta at 1:15 with a plane that wouldn't run. We had to swap planes. And 8:18 this morning, Betty's car was at my son's house. I had one vehicle in my house. Went out 8:18, it wouldn't start. I thought about Trevor both times. And I told him to get ready. But I put a jumper on the truck and it started, so I'm here. But Trevor said he was fully prepared, so he could handle it. I told him I'd be out in Wyoming all week. So, all right, this morning as we begin a new quarter, to me one of the most challenging classes I've ever put together. I'm not sure why, except for trying to get a very good introduction, a broad introduction, deep enough to give us an appreciation for the period of time, because there's quite a bit that takes place. And yet deep enough where we have some substance we can sort of sink our teeth in a little bit and gain some knowledge out of what we're doing. So tomorrow, this morning, it's a combination of the Bible periods, the geography of that age, what was happening in the world empires, what was happening with God's people during that period of time. So it's sort of a collection of those types of things as we go through. I want to start with very, very quickly, in about 2 minutes. This is Wayne Holt. You've seen this many times. Just a real quick review in about 60 seconds. The period that brings us where we're at right now, way back in the beginning with the flood. We'll note a few things here. As I say, this is quick. You're back up here to Shinar. It'll be an area we talk about. You see Babylon on here. You see Egypt. Those are empires we'll be looking at. Abraham came out of Ur of what? Ur of the Chaldees. We'll be talking about the Chaldeans later in the class period this morning. They go days of the patriarchs with Joseph, go down to Egypt. At that point in time, Egypt was a power in the world, not as strong as it had been, or would be later. Here's a 400-year period. We see the first part of the Abrahamic promise being fulfilled down here. Always important. Go back to Genesis chapter 12. They came out a great nation, some 603,000 people strong. And so the nation promise is fulfilled down in Egypt. They come out, they wander for the 40 years. Here's a conquest coming up with the three campaigns. And here the land promise is fulfilled. We'll talk about that a little bit this morning. So in that brief review right there that you've probably got memorized by now, sort of brings gets us closer to the time period that we're talking about. You now have the nation promise fulfilled in Egypt, and now the land promise is fulfilled, which is very key. Now as we come closer to our time, we come up to the period of the king, Saul, David, and Solomon, where the kingdom was united. Move into the period of the divided kingdom, Israel and Judah. Those who have been in this class the last quarter or so have been studying this period of time, the last two periods. Been looking at the kingdoms, 721. We know Israel goes into Assyrian captivity. Now you begin to see on this map a good picture of the world empires that come into play. The Assyrian Empire, really two periods. The Babylonian Empire you see on this, Syria, they're called the Lucids, we'll talk about later, comes up in a later period of history, becomes very dominant. Judah alone for this period of time, for the end of the last quarter, if you're in here, we took a look at this period of time, ended with Judah going into captivity finally in 586 B.C., and we'll back up a little bit before that this morning. Then as we come into the period that we're talking about, here are some dates, some key things here. We're now in the Babylonian Empire period of time, 606, some 536. Here's this period of 70 years that Jeremiah speaks of. We'll see that this morning. So during this period of time, after the fall of Jerusalem, we finally go into captivity, beginning in 606 with the first group, 597 or 598 the second, third group 586. The point's been made many times. You'll see dates that vary, 1 year, 2 years, even with these three dates. Some call the captivity beginning in 605. Some say the second goes in 598. So if you do any reading, you're going to see them vary by year or so, but don't let that trouble you. The key thing is Jeremiah's statement, Jeremiah 29:10, that there would be a period of 70 years. After that period of time, there would be a return. And then the return from captivity. They go into captivity. Now you've got the return from captivity beginning in 536, and Ezra in 558, and Nehemiah in 545. Now this is a period of time that we're talking about right now. And then we go into the years of silence. We'll end our class period today toward the end talking a little bit about the years of silence. Trevor's going to be covering that in detail later on in this quarter. And I put this one up here as we come in the life of Christ. We'll see a slide a little bit later this morning from Daniel chapter 2. Because Daniel chapter 2 in one passage brings us all the way from the days of King Nebuchadnezzar all the way up to the time of Christ in one passage. It's one of the most succinct Bible prophecies in the entire Bible. If you breeze through or browse through, read the book that Bob has, you'll notice he spent quite a bit of time talking about the Bible periods as they intertwine with the world empires. We're here, as always, looking at what does the Bible tell us? The time is very key, certainly is, when you study Bible history, to understand the influence and the powers of the world kingdoms during this period of time. What I've attempted to do in the next couple of slides is sort of match up with the periods of Bible history of the primary world empires. At almost any point in time, there were secondary, maybe even tertiary powers, but these are some of the key influences during these periods of time, like the period of Judges, yet both the Assyrian and the Egyptian. You come down to the United Kingdom, it was Assyrian and the Egyptian as primary. Divided Kingdom, you see the Assyrian and Egyptian, but toward the end of this, as we studied last quarter, you see the Chaldean influence. Did not call that Babylonian because it started out as a Chaldean kingdom further to the south. And you had the Medes to the north. And so as we studied, you had the Chaldeans and the Medes. Neither of them appreciated the Assyrians, who were the world power, and they later come together to defeat Babylon. So you see the rise of these powers during this period of time. Now, as we come into the captivity, you got the Assyrians, certainly, and Egyptian, both great influence during the period of coming into the captivity of Israel, 721. Then Babylon with the battle at Carchemish in 609. You begin to see this transition take place, fall of Nineveh in about 612. So you see the transition of world power from Assyria to Babylon during this period of time. Of course, as you come in then to the Judah with the fall of Jerusalem, then it's King Nebuchadnezzar, and Babylon is a world power during this period of time, with Egypt still being a great influence. The first return under Cyrus, king of Persia, and we'll look at that a little bit later, was prophesied. Certainly the Persian Empire, and you had the Medes. Now, the Persian and Medes, when we come to Daniel 2 and Daniel 8 in just a few minutes, you're going to see that they're sort of together. Not a lot of times in history, it'll talk about the Medo-Persian Empire. When Cyrus became king of Persia, he had already made a conquest of the Medes a little bit to the north of his kingdom of Persia. And so you read about the Medo-Persian Empire, really a combination of the two, beginning with Cyrus of Persia actually conquering the Medes prior even to this period of time. And we'll see the Medo-Persians mentioned in Daniel chapter 8 this morning. Then you come into Sidon 400 years, really the years primarily of the Grecian influence, beginning with 323 with Alexander the Great. He was short-lived. His kingdom divides. We'll talk a little bit about that this morning. And so then you have basically a Grecian empire down to the time of Rome. It's a divided Grecian empire after Alexander, as we'll see in a little bit this morning. But basically a Grecian influence up to the time of the Roman Empire in about 66, 68. So we'll talk about this period of Grecian empire, the Maccabean revolt that came about during that period of time, and why that happened. So these are sort of the Bible periods and the world empires. And this is not an empire. I put this in here because it's an influence that we'll talk about this morning. Very quickly, some maps to get us set where these empires are at. We've got Egypt. And this, you've got Assyria with some dates up here, the early Assyrian Empire, and even later until they finally fall to King Nebuchadnezzar. So you got the Assyrian Empire. You got the Babylonian Empire. Recall, Nebuchadnezzar wanted to take Egypt, never could. He was not able to do that. After Babylon, you got the Persian Empire, which did include Egypt. Persian Empire, you see here, was fairly expansive. So you got the area of Egypt. You got what was Chaldea down here. You got the Median Empire, which was up here. So fairly expansive, even over in Asia Minor, excepting Greece itself. And that was his golden nugget he was never able to quite obtain. But certainly the Persian Empire was a great empire. Now the Median Empire, less expansive than the Persian Empire. And then you got the Greek Empire, beginning with Philip, on down to his son, and Alexander the Great. That brings in about 330 B.C. So here is the empire, the Grecian Empire. Note that Syria is a part of that. Syria, synonymous with the Seleucids, we'll look at it in just a couple of minutes, becomes a great influence over Israel during this period of time. So you see the date here, 331 B.C. Actually, Alexander the Great is killed, or he's not killed, he dies of natural causes. And then the empire is broken up. You might notice this. The two greatest powers coming out of this are the Ptolemies, we'll look at a little bit later, and the Seleucids. But Alexander the Great, although he's a great general and a conqueror, he did poor succession planning. He had no succession planning. So his empire breaks up. Basically, these three and this one were sort of together to sort of separate the empire. Now, Ptolemy, the first one, was not there, but he was a strong enough general that he actually become one of the leaders of the two greatest parts of the Grecian Empire. So these two here are the ones that we want to focus on a little bit later. Ptolemy was down here in Egypt. Seleucus was here in Syria. That's why they become synonymous. Out of this chart right here, remember Ptolemy and Seleucus. They will be the controlling influences over the area of Israel from 321 down to the coming of the Roman Empire. Then the Empire of Rome, tough to put a date on it. You can look at the Empire of Julius Caesar. We certainly know that. More important to us, we come to Augustus Caesar. We'll look at toward the end of the class period. All right? A number of key concepts we need to get firm in our mind. As we've studied through the ages, even up to now, we have to be impressed with God's use and control of nations. We don't have time to look at all these passages, obviously. Now, Jeremiah 18, if you look for a passage that is probably the most specific statements by God that I will use nations, that's a very specific passage, Jeremiah 18. That's the story of the potter. And God says, I'll raise kingdoms up, and I'll cast them down. I'll use kingdoms as I will. And you certainly see this during this period of history. Edom, for example, spoken of by the book of Obadiah. God says, I will bring thee down from hence. A very forthright statement, verifying what Jeremiah prophesied in Jeremiah 18. I'll bring you down from thence. So God definitely uses and controls nations. We're going to look a little bit later. Daniel 2, 37 through 44. Another pretty clear statement, very key to our study. All the way into Romans 13, verse 1, where Paul says, the powers that be are what, Charles? Ordained of God. So this extends into our period of history today. Nothing has changed. God is still in control. Romans 9:17, God raised up Pharaoh, Paul said, Romans 9:17, to demonstrate his power. So individuals God has raised up. Sennacherib, we looked at that last quarter. Cyrus by name is mentioned by Isaiah 44. And Cyrus is one, would be the one that God would raise up to lead his people back from captivity. But he was pre-selected by name, mentioned by name, as the individual that God would use. And of course, we see that in Ezra 1, 2 Chronicles 36, where Cyrus says that I am the appointed of God to take his people back from captivity. And not only from the use of the nations, the control of the nations, Isaiah 10, 12, 13, God had raised Assyria up. And then he says there, I will punish the stout heart of the Assyrians. A great passage. And so he raised Assyria up. Assyria served his purpose. And then God punished Assyria. Likewise with Babylon. a great passage in Habakkuk 1, verse 5 and 6. God tells Habakkuk, he said, Habakkuk, I'm working something that if I told you, you wouldn't even believe it. He said, you would find it unbelievable. And what he was talking about was the use of Babylon to come and to take Judah into captivity. Another clear statement. A passage that we noted last quarter. We have the Egyptian king, Pharaoh Necho, tells Josiah that God told me to come up here. And so if that is a true statement, and that was not just Josiah's supposition, God told him to go up and do battle at that point in time. So the slide here simply reconfirms in our mind with these few examples out of many that God uses and controls nations. It's a very key lesson for any Bible period, especially true in the one we're studying right now. All that happened during this period of time, even though we look at world empires, God is in control. And yet today, God's in control. A lot of solace in that. You can be concerned about what's happening in the world, but you get peace of mind if you just pause for a moment and you put the Islam and all the issues of the world aside and realize that God's in control. And whatever happens in the world, with world empires, this country included, God's in control. So it's God's plan that's been unfolded through the ages of time. Daniel 2, 31 through 44. Next week, we're going to find that when Trevor comes back, he's going to talk this in detail. I'm going to hit a couple highlights this morning. I told him ahead of time I'm not going to steal all of his thunder. Just to pick this passage as one, because it's a key passage. All the prophecies in the Old Testament, I don't know of a better passage that bridges the gap of prophecy from the prophets up until the time of Christ. And the book of Daniel makes it very, very clear as you look at Daniel 2, Daniel 7, and Daniel 8, what's taking place. We should all be somewhat familiar with Nebuchadnezzar's dream. He said, Nebuchadnezzar, thou art the head of gold. And so we know from Daniel 2 that we're talking about world kingdoms. And he tells Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold. So we know where the dream begins. The dream begins with Babylon during the days of Nebuchadnezzar. Because we're told that in chapter 2. Chapter 7, Daniel has another dream about four beasts. Well, here we're talking about four kingdoms in Daniel 2, four beasts in Daniel 7. Daniel has another vision, Daniel 8. And we're truly thankful for what is stated here in Daniel chapter 8, verses 18 through 25. Now, it is not happenstance that we just happen to have mentioned in this passage some countries. Because in Daniel's vision, it's very clearly stated about the he-goat with the two horns. Who does Daniel say that kingdom is? The Medes and the Persians. It's a Medo-Persian empire. So he says, Daniel, here's what you saw. The second kingdom coming up is a Medo-Persian empire. He says, in that ram with that great horn, that's a Grecian empire. Well, God specifically tells us in Daniel chapter 8 that the world empire after Babylon would be the Medo-Persian, and after that would rise a Grecian empire. In a very simple way, easy to understand, easy to explain. You put Daniel 2 and Daniel 8 together, we're able to see what Daniel was saying in Daniel 2 about those great kingdoms. The first three we're told by name who they are. And you look at the description in Daniel 2, 7 and 8. Daniel 2 said the fourth kingdom would be one that would be diverse from all the rest, would be more terrible. And as you look at the history of mankind, first of all, it says the next great kingdom is Rome. There was not another world empire after the Grecian Empire up until the time of Rome. And certainly none even enters the picture except for Rome. Now, Daniel chapter 2 gives us four kingdoms. I like to look at Daniel 2 from the standpoint of the fifth kingdom of Daniel, because Daniel talks about five kingdoms, not four. And the four are not very significant compared to the fifth. But Daniel says, in the days of these kings shall a kingdom be established, shall never be destroyed. As you look at what he's saying in Daniel 2, that's during the days of the fourth kingdom. So it's during the days of the fourth kingdom of Daniel 2 that the kingdom of Christ would be established. You come in the New Testament, during the days of Augustus Caesar, you see the dates there, 31 B.C. to 1418, we had the enrollment where Jesus is born. Not where he was born, the days were born, where he had to go up and be enrolled. And then we have the reign of Tiberius Caesar, beginning 14 A.D. to 37 A.D. Back in Luke chapter 3, verse 1, what year does it say that John the Baptist began to teach? It gives a very specific year. You know, when I was a boy growing up, somebody older, like Jimmy Crass, myself, I was here 33 A.D. at the beginning of the church. And for many, many years, I wondered, well, how do we know if 33 A.D. is some preacher pulling that out of the air? But as I grew older and began to study, it's very specific. You can narrow that down very, very easily. As it tells us there, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius, 14 plus 15, at about 29 A.D., John the Baptist began his teaching. About 6 months later, Jesus began. Well, 33 A.D., when you look at the work of Jesus, about 2 years, becomes a very real period of time. And so it becomes very important for us, even as we think about the beginning of the kingdom, well, during the days of these kings, that is the Roman kings, that the kingdom of heaven was established as recorded in Acts chapter 2. So a great passage. This passage will take you from Babylon to Pentecost in Daniel chapter 2. And by the way, I'll be glad to share these slides if anybody wants them. I'm going way too fast for you to get everything down. Appreciate you taking notes. Another key concept, obviously, is the concept of a remnant. God has always, through the ages, determined to spare a remnant. From the time that God created mankind, if you look at the thread of the threads of history, there's always a remnant. The days of the flood we saw momentarily ago for about 2 seconds. Noah and his house was spared. How many people? 8. That's a remnant, right? That's a remnant. If you wore a shirt this morning with just that size remnant, you wouldn't have much of a shirt on. All right? A very, very tiny remnant of mankind was spared. And so as you come up through the ages of time, this concept of a remnant of God preserving people and His people continues through the age of time. Now, very specifically, before the captivity, we find Jeremiah stating, Jeremiah 30, verse 3, and many other passages in that period of history. It was covered last time by Freddie and Eric in great detail. But behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, I will bring back from captivity my people, Israel and Judah. And so here was a prophecy that the remnant would return. Very key thought when you talk to people about the premillennial theory, which we're going to thread into our study this quarter, because there's some things happening here that are very central to the discussion of somebody with the premillennial doctrine. But it says, there is hope in your future, says the Lord, your children shall come back to their own border. So they would come back. So some very specific prophecies that there would be a remnant who would return from captivity in Jeremiah 29:10. Jeremiah says, that's going to be 70 years. And this indeed is a passage apparently that Daniel saw after he was in captivity. The exact year we don't know, but coming up close we speculate to 70 years, he says. As he was reading from Jeremiah, he realized a 70-year period of time apparently was drawing close when this remnant would return. That Daniel was a prophet there. It even comes in Romans 9:27, there would be a spiritual remnant. A spiritual remnant. And so it's been God's plan from the very beginning that He would always have a people. Even after the fall of the Roman Empire, 325, through all the dark ages, or through changes that took place, God's people have been there. There's been a remnant, yet to today. So the idea of a remnant is very central. Quick slide, some key events during this period of time. 605, the first carrying away in captivity, or 606, Daniel taking that group. 597, Ezekiel goes with the second group, begins his work in about 592. The final fall, Jerusalem, 586. As we go into captivity, those are the three key dates. The first return, 536. First return, about 536. Again, we don't have an exact year. We know from Ezra chapter 1 and 2 Chronicles chapter 36, identical statements, identical records for the most part in 2 Chronicles 36 and Ezra 1, where Ezra recognizes that he is the appointed of God to bring back the captive. Now, specifically for Israel, but not only Israel. Assyria's policy had been what? When they conquered land, what did they do, James? They scattered the people, transplanted them. Cyrus did not agree with that. And so his policy was just the opposite. He didn't do that. So he allowed people to return, not just Israel. So he basically reversed the policy of the Assyrians and allowed people in general to return. Our perspective, of course, is on Israel, as they were allowed to return from captivity. Now they came back, began to build a temple under Cyrus. So I put the beginning of the temple being built at 536. Sometimes you'll see the dates of 520 to 516. Because they come back under Cyrus, they start, and they stop. Pick up again in 520 and actually completed in 516 when the prophet Haggai and Zechariah come on the scene and begin to prophesy and encourage the people. So the building of the temple completed 516. Then the second return under Ezra, 458, third under Nehemiah, and the walls of Jerusalem are finally rebuilt. So the focus of the return, number one, build a temple. Secondly, rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And so the focus was on the city of Jerusalem. So these are the key events we're going to be looking at during these periods of history as we come in and study these prophets. Now, a brief introduction to the silent 400 years. This comes toward the very end of our study in August. Cover very carefully. It's going to take two class periods and answer all the questions you ever had about the silent 400 years. And he will implore you to not be silent during that class period this year. All right? Here's sort of a period of time called the silent 400 years for what reason, Larry? All right, but why do we call it the silent 400 years?
There is
no revelation. The book of Malachi written about 440. So now this is not a Bible term. You're not going to go anywhere and say, now this is the silent or was the silent 400 years. It's a term that we've coined. We need to be careful. We might, even in 17 periods of Bible history, which we use. That's just a way to keep it in our mind, right? So we don't want to make it a catechism, if you will. It's a good way to remember it. And this term here is this term that man's made that God simply didn't speak during that period of time. From about 440 with the book of Malachi, so that's what I refer to as a silent 400 years. History continued on. Israel continued on during that period of time. Now the chart you memorized earlier after the breakup of the Grecian Empire, I said remember two. The Ptolemies were the first. Ptolemy was a general under Alexander the Great, perhaps his strongest general. When they divided the empire of Alexander, he was not present, but he was so strong that he ended up taking the nation of Egypt. Seleucus actually laid rightful claim to it, but Ptolemy was strong enough that it was actually his land. So you associate Ptolemy with Egypt, even though he's in Egypt, he's Greek. So you got the Grecian Empire with one great influence in the nation of Egypt during this period of time. So you got to sort of keep your mind straight because it's sort of mind-bending that it's happening in Egypt. He's in Egypt, but yet he's a Greek general. And it's a Grecian influence during this period of time. Now, generally speaking, from 320 to 198, a prosperous time for the Jews. Some key things happen. High priests are elevated to take care of the Jewish affairs, sort of the internal affairs. As you come in the New Testament, who are very prominent in the New Testament? Annas, Caiaphas, what were they? Trenton. They're high priests. So it was during this period of time that the high priests began to rise up. Ptolemy didn't want to be concerned, apparently, or Seleucus, with the everyday running of the Jewish affairs. Somebody comes to me and Roger has a complaint that he wanted to marry my near kinsman, but I wouldn't take my shoe off, and I wouldn't honor the law. Well, Seleucus, Ptolemy, they didn't want to be concerned about those matters. Well, high priests would be the ones who would sort of take care of these internal affairs, questions about the Jewish law. As you come in the New Testament, there were restrictions, right? Even that period of time, what's one thing they could not do? Couldn't put anybody to death, right? So during a period of time, we see this take place. The Septuagint was translated in about 285 B.C. What is the Septuagint? Greek translation of the Old Testament. So this is the first time that non-Jews could read and understand the Old Testament. So very, very significant during a period of time. Then you had the period of the Seleucids, And again, this is synonymous with Syria. During the year, even yet today, there's no love lost between Syria and Israel, even today, hundreds and hundreds of years later. This became a period of history where the people of Israel, the Jews, even though they were under Seleucus and the Seleucids during this period of time, it was not a good time. Antiochus III defeats Egypt, the Ptolemies, and he assumes control over Israel, especially under Antiochus IV, Epiphanes. One of Trevor's lessons will deal with the last three chapters of the book of Daniel, the easy chapters. I'll take some of the harder ones up in front with Daniel 3 with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and I left him the easy ones. So he will answer all your questions in the latter part of Daniel. That appears to be talking about some of the events in this period of time. But Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, was very oppressive. He burnt copies of the Old Testament law. He forbade some of the worship, even the keeping of the Sabbath during this period of time. So a 30-year period of time, 198 to 166, we see a great oppression of Israel during his period. That led rise to the Maccabean revolt. And begins with Judas Maccabee, actually Mattathias, his father. But Judas is really the first of the great Maccabeans who led this revolt. 165, he came in, he purified the temple in Jerusalem, which had been desecrated by Antiochus IV. Today they celebrate Hanukkah in December 7th every year, the Festival of Lights. Now, Hanukkah goes back to this event in 165 B.C. It's not a substitute for Christmas. It actually goes back, and they celebrate the purifying of the temple in 165 B.C. So the nation of Israel, the Jewish people today, look back on this as a very significant period of time in their history, because they suffered great oppression at the hands of basically the Syrians or the Seleucids during this period of history. We then come down to the next period of history with the Roman Empire, Julius Caesar we know about, Brutus, Antoinette, all those things, Cleopatra, all those things happen. They're not just fictitious stories. Those are real people in history. Not mentioned in the Bible until you come down to Augustus Caesar. And Augustus becomes very key, beginning reigning 31 B.C. until 14 A.D. And now you see a difference right here, B.C. to A.D. So we understand something very significant happens during that period of time, right? What is that, Matt? What happens in there that changes that? All right, we got the birth of Christ in this period of time right here. So you go from B.C. to A.D. during the reign of Augustus Caesar. And following him is Tiberius Caesar, we saw it a moment ago. Again, very significant. Because in the 15th year reign of Tiberius, John the Baptist began teaching in the wilderness, which puts it 29 A.D. So this is sort of this period of time right here, the silent 400 years. Key learnings. A lot of things we'll be looking at during this quarter. A remnant returns. If you think about the seed promise made back to Abraham, it required a remnant to return. If you look at 2 Samuel chapter 7, the seed of David, a king would be raised up, right? Talking about Christ. Genesis 49:12, the scepter would not leave the tribe of Judah, of the line of Judah. Genesis 49:12, all the way back to Genesis, up through 2 Samuel. And so the preservation of Israel as a nation was absolutely essential, because as you come to Matthew chapter 1 and you see the genealogy of Christ, it was preserved up to that period of time. So if Israel had ceased to exist as a nation, and no remnant was preserved, the seed promise, as it's stated in the Old Testament, would never have occurred of the tribe of David. It may have been a Jew, but the remnant was preserved. Even in from spiritually in Romans 9:27, Paul makes reference there to the remnant, the spiritual remnant. After 400 years of silence, Galatians 4:4, the fullness of time, Jesus came forth, born of woman, born under the law. And so there's a key learning here. A remnant returns. Great spiritual implications. God keeps His promises. The nation promise in Egypt, the land promise, the seed promise, and the remnant preserved, Romans 9:27. Another great lesson we'll see as we go through the quarter is God's control over nations. We're all going to sort of also weave into this a premillennial theory, some very key things. Joshua 21:45, a verse we need to know where it's at. That God, of all that God promised Israel, He failed not to do every bit of it. Alright, that was the land promise fulfilled. They came into Canaan. Then the promise is about a remnant would return. You must be able to talk to a premillennialist and explain to them and show them from scriptures how that was also fulfilled. Because today they say, oh yeah, we agree. They went into Canaan, but they were taken to captivity. God said to bring it back and build a nation. That didn't happen until 1945 when they finally recognized a sovereign nation. Jeremiah 22, verse 30. What's that about Coniah or Jeconiah's seed there with Jeremiah? None of Coniah or Jeconiah's seed will sit upon the throne of Israel and prosper. Very, very, very key passage from a premillennial standpoint. So a lot of things, a lot of passage in here. These are just some of the key learnings, I think, from this period of time. And we'll be emphasizing these as we go through the quarter. A lot of things we can learn. Prophets, Daniel, of course, we've talked about. Goes away into first captivity, we know at least until the years of Cyrus. So about 70 years at least, perhaps a little bit longer. Significant messianic content, as we've talked about in Daniel. Jeremiah, beginning Josiah, attending a Babylonian captivity. Talked about God's judgment, a final plea for repentance. Ezekiel went into captivity, 597. Ezekiel gives them spiritual hope, provides some guidance to the captives. Haggai, main message, arise and build a house. Haggai chapter 1. He said, my house is lying waste. He began his work in the second year of Darius. So we know it's about 520 B.C. when Haggai begins his work. Zechariah, again about the same time, about 520. Came back to the first group in 536. A messianic prophecy. And finally, Malachi, very significant. It's interesting, about 100 years after they came back, they've fallen away again. Israel doesn't change. Malachi is a very stinging rebuke of Israel. They've forgotten the moral law. They've cast that aside. They've forgotten the ceremonial law. They've profaned the worship. They've become indifferent. So it appears from Malachi the years of captivity really served no purpose for them from a spiritual standpoint. God brought them back, but they were the same. A key prophecy in Malachi 4, the prophetic coming of Elijah. Jesus says in Matthew 17 that Elijah has returned in the person of John the Baptist. Well, that's sort of Malachi. And then we had Ezra, chronicle history of return under Cyrus, Darius, Artaxerxes. Then Nehemiah leads a return to rebuild the walls. Esther appears during this period of time. We place the book of Esther in this period of history. There's a lot happening. Not a lot of time for comments this morning, but sort of a brief introduction of what we're going to see throughout this period of time. Everybody should be leaving with both a schedule for the quarter and also the work for next week. All right, thank you. Probably two of those. All right.